Monday, April 27th, and you found Irish Illustrated Insider at exactly the right time at the conclusion of the Spring Football 2026 at Notre Dame. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by Tim Priester and Drew Mantock of Irish Illustrated. Guys, we'll focus on the 95th annual Blue Gold game, but really Marcus Freeman's fifth spring session as head coach. Talk about the NFL draft a little bit as well. Let's start with the Blue Gold game because we got to dedicate our Monday and probably our Thursday, right, to what happened in the annual scrimmage. Overreaction would be Blake Hebert was better than I thought he would be, but that's good news for him. Overreaction from a small group is CJ Carr was not superhuman like they wanted him to be. I want to read one thing from the 2009 Blue Gold game recap. I know you guys weren't planning on that, but you guys remember a guy Jimmy Clausen, who was the most accurate quarterback in Notre Dame history in his ensuing season. Clausen looked relatively comfortable in the pocket yesterday. He moved around and didn't panic, but he was not very accurate outside the hash marks and threw a pick six. His stats were nothing special, but maybe they wanted to focus on the running game. Montana played great yesterday. He had a nice pass down the middle of the field to Mike Ragone off play action and certainly looked like a capable number two option. So with that, I will turn it over to you.
That wasn't Joe Montana. Yeah, we'll get into that. I did tail the tape, so I have a lot of thoughts on that. I want to focus on probably the best player on the field Saturday, and that was Jaden Sanders. I mean, yeah. he shut down.
My guy to watch going into the game on.
Yeah, there you go. Good call. Yeah, you know, and Micah Gilbert. There were a lot of eyes on him, and that was who Sanders had. I thought Sanders did a great job on him. Did a very good job on Cam Williams too. The few times that he went against him, it's a guy that's been playing nickel all spring, and whatever reason there really was for Leonard Moore not playing, you can just say he's so great we didn't want to put him out here to get nicked up going into the summer. You can say that too.
He put on a wrist brace and start limping like he forgot what he was supposed to be covering up.
But anyway, Sanders switched over to the boundary and did a really, really good job. So I first and foremost want to point him out. I continue to be impressed with Ethan Long at safety. We always talk about, you know, the newcomers and what they can do. Don't forget about, you know, some of the freshmen, redshirt freshmen, I guess, in particular that are, you know, have been in the system a little bit longer and know things better. And Ethan Long's a player. And as I think we mentioned on the postgame incident analysis, there's a good chance that Shuler, Johnson, and Telich are all gone next year. And so, you know, those two young guys are going to have to step up. But I thought Gilbert and I'm sorry, I thought Sanders and Ethan Long really stood out on the defensive side.
Yeah, I agree. There's no reason to read too much into Carr's performance. I know everyone else didn't see it, but that jersey scrimmage the weekend before is the scrimmage that mattered the most in terms of what the coaches are looking at too. So I think the fact that he lived up to that situation and that pressure matters more than him doing it in front of fans in a game that's fun. Marcus Freeman's talking to the broadcast half the time and not fully paying attention. Like, they don't take it quite as seriously. He did way better in the situation that I think really mattered this spring. And that's worth noting. And I think we're so used to him being so accurate that there are some of those plays where they're pretty well covered, and we know Carr could have fit in there and maybe gotten that pass to Micah Gilbert or got it deep down the field to Gilbert when the safety was coming over and hit those things. So we know we can, but it's not like he was so far off. He just wasn't perfect in some of those situations that we're used to seeing him in. So I know his numbers weren't great, but I don't think there's much reason to react to that at all.
And credit to Blake Hebert. I didn't want to minimize that. That's the best we've seen him look throwing.
No doubt.
In fairness to Hebert, he did not participate in the jersey scrimmage, and I don't remember a single thing about him last spring when he was an early enrollee. In an August camp, he was the fourth. It was a scout team way down there. You know, so that's how it works. But yeah, he did a nice job. He threw a couple nice balls. We have a lot of wide receiver commentary coming up in segment two. I thought the defensive line rotation, Tim, I want to lead into you because your main question is, can you get 12 real snaps from Armel Mukum? Not 12 snaps. You could get 12 snaps against Rice and against Purdue, and you're going to. You're going to get over 100 snaps from Mukum because they're going to blow the doors off some people. But if Mukum plays 12 snaps against Wisconsin before the fourth quarter, or 10 snaps before the fourth quarter, there's a trust factor there, and that's what you kind of think would help that line.
Of course, we have to keep in mind that Jason Onyeka didn't play on Saturday, and so he – you know, there's a clear number four, and Teyon Gray and Francis Brew and Elijah Hughes and Jason Onyeka.
But they need more than 10 snaps. They need 20 and 30.
That's those guys do. I don't want to read too much into it. And it seems like Armel Mukum's been there, and he has been for a long, long time, and was almost eased out of the situation after last season. But, you know, he's worked with the starters. He worked with the starters each of the last 2 weeks. Again, Onyeka's out. But he worked with the starters, and he's just a big body that he does have some explosiveness off the snap of the football. And so if that's your fifth, if you can get 8, 10, 6, 7, depending on, you know, game and situation. And as you said, Tim, there'll be times where he can play 18 snaps because of what they're doing to the opponent. Then you preserve the other guys from getting nicked up, you know, later in a game when they don't have to, and you build that depth. The other thing is, you know, DN, I mean, Rodney Dunham, and Marcus Freeman said it the week before. I mean, he thinks he's going to be impactful this season, and everything we've seen from Rodney Dunn looks like he'll be impactful in 2026.
I'd turn it over to Drew, because ever since you said this, Drew, I can't get out of my mind. He's the top-rated draft. He's the top-rated guy in the class and a five-star. We're just like, oh, yeah, Rodney Dunham's on the team too. But it's clearly going to matter that he's come along this far.
Absolutely. And I mean, he's the best recruit, if you look at 24/7, they've had in, what, a decade? Like, he's not even, you know, like, he is just so high out there. But we don't think of him that way. I know he's hurt in high school a little bit, but he's living up to those type of expectations. I mean, it's not like we've seen one practice where he's looked good. Every time we've seen him, he's made multiple havoc plays. He's put on a lot of weight. He's up over 240 pounds, and it's just hard to see. It's a position they also needed somebody to step up. You know, I know there's still hope for Keaton Keeley, and he did some okay things over the weekend too. But the fact that you can have Dunn and kind of pencil him in as a real depth piece who can be consistent, who plays hard, and can make some of those negative plays that you really need for this defense to go without having to always rush or send a multiple blitzers. Like, I think that's really huge.
I think everybody's excited about Spencer Porath after the last two regular season years of kicking. I want to remind people that Mitch Jeter was actually a great pickup for Notre Dame. He just got hurt, and it was ruined that season, and then he was 7 of 7 until he missed against Ohio State. He was fantastic. If Spencer Porath can go 7 for 8 in the playoffs this year, then he can match Mitch Jeter. But they really have a consistent kicker, and you need it. It just changes your play calling, Priester. It changes things in close games and how you have to approach your down and distance and everything else.
It's just so free and easy. You don't see any, you know, a whole lot of wobble on his kicks one direction or the other, slice or, you know, or what have you, hook. It's just free and easy. And, you know, you can say, okay, it wasn't a game-like situation, but man, you got the entire football organization on the field, right? On the field on each side of you. You got the crowd, but you have everybody in the football program beyond players, assistants, trainers, et cetera, lined up, and he just calmly drills it. So, yeah, I mean, he made, what, 13, 14 kicks in a row the last two weekends?
Yeah. How I feel about it doesn't really matter, but when they put him on the field for that 43-yarder at the end of the game, if this were last year's kickers, I would have stopped and had to like fully focus on it. And I just kept writing from the press box because I'm probably going to make this. And I think that's the level of confidence that he's earned and deserved. And you have a guy that you should feel, oh, he's going to make a 43-yard kick in front of, you know, 40,000 fans and people right on him. Like, I just assumed he was going to make it, and I didn't need to watch it. I just kind of paid attention and saw the scoreboard change a little.
Last year at Pitt, Priester, we'd have been wondering, all right, is this going to be a bad snap that's a little off? Is that the reason he misses, or is this going to be it? But it was just straight up, you knew Porath was going to make the kick. It's a luxury. It's a luxury you should have nowadays, because in the era of, even though college kickers are not NFL kickers, at Notre Dame, you should have a great kicker, and they should have a very good kicker in Spencer Porath. The depth, we talked about depth. I don't want to get to the second part of this before we get to the draft. The depth of Notre Dame's defense is what we talked about most of the spring, and I think Snead and Osbury getting all that time, and Madden Faremo, who must be back healthy, otherwise they wouldn't have let him hit. I think their linebacker core, because of that, is just going to be so improved when Viliamuasa and Bowen are full strength. Bowen will be full strength before Viliamuasa. Yeah. I think it's an underrated storyline, and that's why I asked about Osbury and Snead. It's really interesting to me, too, that Ash is like, yeah, they just never played together because he pairs people up, and you needed a middle linebacker. And now those guys have both played middle and will. It's really interesting situation going into August camp.
It's a good group. It was good to see Framo running full speed.
For real, yeah.
Don't you think Viliamuasa, one way or another, is going to he'll be playing sooner than we are expecting right
but
now.
But the real Viliamuasa will be back at some point too, and that's right. When it gets
we've got to rate these players now as we start our countdown coming up here in May, and I'm having a really hard time figuring out where I place Viliamuasa because he is going to miss the first month, I would imagine, at least. So I'm going to place him down further just because of that. But that's one of your three or four best players on the football team. And it does, you know, I mean, we didn't see Bowen the whole spring. I mean, we saw him, but he didn't do anything really, you know, live. It is a really, really good group. Snap for snap, I don't know if anybody's around the ball more than Osbury. Snead is an explosive player. There's a consistency factor there that has to be met. It's a really good group, and I think we come out of the spring seeing Teddy Rezac and Ko Okia as a couple guys that, all right, they're making progress too, and their time will come. At no point did we feel that way about any of the other linebackers last year. So, you know, they're on pace to, and they'll get, you know, again, because of the schedule, they'll get playing time this year, and they'll get opportunities to get their feet wet before they're really thrown into the fray in 2027.
Yeah, it'll be interesting too, because I mean, as we talked about, Sanders may have been the most impressive defender from the blue gold game, and he's their backup nickel. That's their base defense now, but they have five linebackers you realistically want to play. So it's just interesting that what are they going to do in the fall once you get Bowen back, once you get KVA back too? Is like, how are you, that's like just an embarrassment of riches at the spot that you really only consistently need two guys in the field for too. So I think how they rotate those guys in, especially with some of those other younger guys you want to see, like, it's going to be really intriguing to monitor.
One spot Notre Dame needs five consistent guys at the field is also offensive line. And blue gold game is a very hard way to judge the offensive line. But I did take Dembrock at his word. Matty Augustine had such a good spring that we should not pencil the starting five just yet. And that's good news.
I would agree. And I think we're talking about the right guard spot. I don't think that we're talking about the other four positions. Sullivan Absher, I think, continues to take his game to a higher level. But, you know, I think that Matty Augustine is a guy. I think he threw the block on, man, I got so many plays in my head from tail of the tape. He threw a block on a short touchdown run. And it was pretty decisive. It was against Mookum. That's who it was.
Jonas Walton's run? Yeah.
I'm not sure now, but it was a short touchdown run. So there was William's short touchdown run and his short touchdown run. And Augustine really, really pushed Mookum off the football. So, and we probably talked more about Mookum. You know, I mean, he's still down the list here as far as depth chart. But yeah, I agree. I don't think, you know, Mike Denbrock throws stuff out there if there's not some legitimacy to it. And that's a good situation. It's good for Absher, certainly good for Augustine. It's good for the offensive line in general.
Yeah, and right now he's your backup tackle at both spots too. So the fact that they were working him in at guard, which maybe isn't his most natural position, I think was always a sign that they wanted him to see what he could do there and be ready for that. Otherwise, you just leave him at tackle and see, you know, Chris Tarrick, your backup, or maybe Ashton Craig, when he comes back, makes it a little easier for him or Joe Adding to back up interior offensive lineman. But like the fact that they were moving him around so much this spring made it seem like they wanted him to compete at both spots, but especially at guard.
Drew, you referenced did you reference a rep from Tarrick where he got walked back?
I did.
That was Brew, right? That was Brew that was on.
I thought there was one where Sevolano kind of shed Tarrick and got a tackle for, or it, maybe it was a no gain. I don't know if it's a tackle for loss, but I do remember that from the game that Tarrick just didn't win against a guy who would say is a third teamer, not necessarily going to play.
Yeah, Sevolano did some good things Saturday.
We're going to come full circle with our Notre Dame draft recap by going first to Drew Mentok, since he covered the draft from start to finish at the NFL Combine. Six guys drafted, Drew. Not the six guys we thought were going to get drafted.
Yes, I thought it would be all offensive players who would get drafted, but Gabriel Rubio sneaking in the sixth round. I do think, I mean, you heard Nick Saban talk about it on College Game Day before the first day of the draft, that this is really where the NFL is feeling NIL and how it impacts maybe who's going to be available. Because now if you're a day four pick, you may as well, or day three pick, excuse me, you may as well stay in college and probably get paid more. We know Riley Leonard made more as a senior at Notre Dame than he did his first year in the NFL. So I think maybe that helps a guy like Rubio, though, in this instance, where he's got an NFL size. He's got a high character guy for the most part. It's worth the Steelers taking a swing on him. But I don't think four or five years ago he gets drafted. But obviously the highlight of the draft is having two running backs go in the first round for the first time. First time the top two running backs have been taken from the same school in the common draft era. I guess it happened once at SMU in like the 1940s. So we don't fully count that. But yeah, really interesting. Crazy the difference. I mean, Jeremiah Love has now the most guaranteed money amongst running backs by, I think it's $15 million or more. Jadarian Price also doing pretty well. It's different. Crazy the discrepancy, because he's making about, his contract is worth about $17 million, which my wife guessed accurately when I asked her what she thought he'd make. But just going at the end of the first round, there's still a huge amount of money Price is getting, but just kind of crazy how much less it is. But obviously, great day for them. Great day for Notre Dame. I think we're seeing them get skill players drafted highly, and those are the type of guy, like, it's great when Joe Alt goes fifth overall, but that doesn't make the headlines as Jeremiah Love and Price both going in the first round.
I like how Samson always laughs when someone says, it doesn't really matter if they're a first or second round pick if they do well. Yeah, yeah, it does. Actually, for the rest of their lives, it does matter a little bit if they're first or second round pick and where they are drafted. But that's what a landing spot for Price. Rubio's a big enough surprise where we did not have a Gabriel Rubio story prepared. That's how big those surprises are. Those don't happen very often. That also happened once that I can remember in the recent recruiting era to Mr. Tom Loy. And nobody knew it was coming. Emil Wagner, when he came to Notre Dame, nobody had a story prepared. And we still think, I still think that's the coolest thing ever, that Tom never misses on that. Well, nobody had it, not only just Tom. Shout out to Tom Loy. But Emil Wagner not getting drafted. You could feel it coming as the draft progressed. Unfortunate for him. But as you know what, when you land free agent, when you're signed as a free agent and you have an opportunity, sometimes that is a little better because there's no guaranteed money coming from those seventh round guys anyway.
Very few of my predictions from the draft. We did say guesses the other day. Very few of my guesses the other day were accurate. One of them was that Shrouth would be drafted two rounds ahead of Wagner. I had Shrouth in the fifth round. I was thinking Wagner in the seventh. He didn't get picked. We have a question. Is that in the second segment, Tim, about that? I won't get into that yet, but. So no, we're not shocked by that. The Rubio thing did catch me off guard, and great for him. What a great opportunity! But you know, and Raritan in the third round, I don't think there were too many projections in the third round. I had heard a fourth round. You guys were right about Malachi Fields. I mean, he wasn't going to get out of the third round. The Giants like those big those W receivers from Notre Dame. So. You know, great opportunity for those two guys. My feeling after the first 2 days was, you know, Love, probably we didn't expect Price to go in the first round. You know, so here's a bunch of Notre Dame guys. I'm thinking, okay, Marcus Freeman coach players, Notre Dame's better, recruiting's better. The NFL's looking at these Notre Dame players in a little different way than they maybe once did, and projecting them a little bit higher than they have been in recent years.
Yeah, to the Eli Raritan point too, he went, I think, 68 picks ahead of Mitchell Evans from not that long ago, which, do you think about, I would have pegged Mitchell Evans as a better prospect, and they both had knee injuries and things like that to deal with too. So just, I think, kind of comparing that, and to your point, TP, that maybe there is a little bit of a perception shift that could be a reason that contributed to his.
Very quickly, we'll talk about a couple of these guys in segment two, but free agent signings for people that have not heard: Devonta Smith to the Panthers, Will Pauling and Jalen Stroman to the 49ers, Botello to the Vikings, was Wagner to the Titans, Jake Tofelsky invited to rookie camp for the Titans and Vikings, and James Rendell invited to the Bucs camp. Five-tool punter. He will probably find a role. James Rendell can kick that football. Tim Priester. Safety, Zayden Gamble was the pledge. Didn't say, almost said signee. I almost always say signee. Pledge from Fort Lauderdale, St. Thomas Aquinas after the Blue Gold game. I know you did a film review on him.
Yeah, you know, I think a really a really intelligent, a really smart football player that knows how to play the game. Predominantly a zone coverage defense, so there may be some one-on-one matchups, although, I mean, you see him in camp settings and he's really, really smooth. So I think the transition to locking down on a guy will be fairly smooth for him. You know, that St. Thomas Aquinas program's won seven straight state titles. Good Lord. So it's a winning program. They
don't play any
good
football down in Florida, though, right, Tim? So it doesn't really
matter. And you know they play a very challenging schedule. They always have.
Nationally,
they have to, yeah, they have to look for better competition. So, you know, that's great. You knew I had to comment about Zayden Gamble celebrating after every big play that he makes, because I'm a jerk like that. But he does that. It's no big deal, but he has a little bit of bravado to him. He's in the top 175. And again, I always, like, when I feel like I see a number and I think it should be one way or another, I throw it out. And all I said was, all things being equal. And again, I haven't seen everybody in the country, and I never do any year. But having done this for a long, long time, just all things being equal and being relative, would I say top 175? Nah, I'd say maybe that's a little high. Would I say top 200, 210? Probably. So we're looking at a really good football player. Notre Dame is going to have a good haul on the back end, and this is a kid that knows how to play, plays hard, plays smart, and again, is used to. He made the comparison between St. Thomas Aquinas and Notre Dame, and that's an easy comparison. He should fit in really well at Notre Dame.
You mentioned his high school program. It's also a place where a lot of Notre Dame fans know Julius Jones Jr., son of Julius Jones, the Notre Dame running back, also plays for that school. So I have to think that's going to help with him. And Notre Dame also offered Jones's brother, Andre, who's a safety. I think he's 2028 a few weeks ago, too. So I think this commitment also helps with another recruitment that Notre Dame might view as even more important.
Quick point of comparison. I did a very quick look. Adon Shuler was number 317. I know Adon Shuler was all on our list of, I like the signing, but he was better than we thought he was going to be. Is that the best way to talk about Shuler? I like that signing, but he's better than we thought he'd be. 317 now seems so low for Adon Shuler, but I guess we were kind of in the camp of, I like it, I see it, I get it. And where do you have, like, Gamble? Can you remember the Adon Shuler film? It's tough to do that. I mean, obviously, you have Brian Moore, so that's, I'm trying to give you
I don't put too much credence in any of that. It's hard for me to, at this stage, because Shuler's become such a leader and a physical player on the back end of the defense, it's hard for me to think of him as a lesser player, you know, when he came out of high school. And I know I liked him, but yeah, you know, it's like when we were asked about, you know, who are the fastest guys on the team. I don't go based upon where they were ranked in high school. You go based upon what you see now, and the same way with speed. I don't care what they run on a track, although that's important. It's what they run on a football field, which is, I mean, Will Pauling, I still am having difficulty.
You got a chance to talk about Will Pauling coming up. Yeah.
I find that difficult that he put up those numbers, because I can, when I did the film review of him coming from Wisconsin, I said, he doesn't have breakaway speed. He's more of a possession receiver. And I still believe that, the 4.37 at Pro Day notwithstanding.
Final note, Chance Tucker, 2021 recruit, transferring to North Dakota State. Good for Chance. I'm glad he probably has multiple degrees from Notre Dame. Don't you guys think? That was, he's always been a media favorite, and he just beset by injuries. And then all of a sudden, Mike Mickens' recruiting machine and Marcus Freeman's recruiting machine. We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. First question is from Wash ND, longtime subscriber and contributor. After watching the Jersey scrimmage and the Blue Goal game, which of the following players do you believe helped themselves the most to crack the two deep this fall? He lists Blake Hebert, who obviously has a chance, Devin Fitzgerald, Elijah Burris, those guys have a lot of competition, Rodney Dunham, and Ko'o Kia, who has all of the competition.
Drew, go ahead. I don't want to do this just based upon the last two weekends, although we saw most of what we saw was the last two weekends. But I mean, I would, I would, I put this in terms of based upon what happened the entire spring, where would you put him?
Yeah, I mean, I think Rodney Dunham of this whole list is the one I'm most confident will be in the two deep. It seems really hard, as I mentioned in segment one, just to keep somebody like that on the field. He seems to be doing it consistently for a freshman. He has all the talent in the world. I'm sure that might be Blake Hebert just because of just where his competition is too. I mean, to, you know, freshman one, it's not arriving until the summer. I do question, I know the blue goal game, he showed some good things. I do wonder if you're, especially if you're looking at a backup, somebody who come in like an emergency situation, I would question his ability to make the easy throws. I think those are things he still struggled in with the blue goal game. He had that, I know it was still converted for a fourth down to Bubba Frazier, but it was really underthrown. If you're getting a ball like that to Frazier, he might be one of the fastest guys on the team. I think if he came in an emergency situation, kind of like what we saw even with Carr against Miami, where Dembrock likes to call those kind of easy access throws, the phase on, get it out quickly, maybe get it to somebody on the move. I don't know that he can do that, and I think that would probably be a big part of the offense if he came in into that situation. So I'm going to say him, but I don't know that I have a lot of confidence. I think I've seen he can do some of the other throws and make some of the plays, but I think the easy stuff is something I still question with him.
I'd definitely start with Rodney Dunham. I thought Logan Thomas flashed a little bit in the blue goal game, and that was good to see. Looked really quick off the edge. The touchdown score by Elijah Burris was impressive on both ends from Hebert throwing through. You see these three sets of arms that he ended up throwing through, and Burris beat Chaz Smith off the snap and got to the back of the end zone, did a nice job with his footwork and stuff. So he's on the two deep. It's hard. He's more of an X, and it's going to be hard to get Jordan Faison off the field. So, yeah, Dunham definitely is in the two deep. I think Burris is definitely in the two deep. After that, it's a little, well, Fitzgerald. I mean, I think Fitzgerald has a chance. We'll talk about Micah Gilbert a little bit and the progress that he needs to make. And I think Devin Fitzgerald certainly put himself in position to ascend to that number two spot. But, we only saw his reps against a guy like Chaz Smith or, you know, some of the backups. I'm sure along the way he had opportunities to go against the number one defense. And when they get into the summer, you know, he'll be going against the Leonard Moores and DJ McKinney's of the world. And so that'll be a good test for him. But, I don't know. Kia, I don't know. He's quite there yet, but we know that he's making progress. Yeah, I mean, Fitzgerald, Burris, and Dunham, I think, are definitely strongly in the mix.
Yeah, I think Dunham will play against Wisconsin. And I think as the season progresses, Fitzgerald is in the top six of wide receivers. And Elijah Burris, I've been on Elijah Burris, is kind of, he's going to emerge this year. Don't forget the second year player bandwagon. I'm really glad he made a play because other than Mike Dembrock telling me how good he is, other than knowing his playbook, I've never seen him make a play. So that was great to see Elijah Burris make that. As Drew said, that's the best throw we've ever seen from Blake Hebert. That was a start. What did you say? Through a sway of humanity, Tim Priest, or the arms?
I saw three sets of arms waving through it. It was thrown over Telich. He was the last guy.
Kia probably had the third best spring of this group, if you're looking at, or second, if you're looking at Dunham, Fitzgerald, and Kia, but he has five starters in front of him. So you want to see Ko'o Kia in the two deep in 2027, not 2026, because that means something went wrong. There's a lot of good linebackers in front of him. Next question, Tally Alley. This is a practice question. How do you guys differentiate, who will be an impact player versus a potential liability when you're watching head-to-head reps? For example, if Traore is consistently bleeding Will Black, how do you evaluate Will Black's expectations given Traore is a potential first-rounder? And I want to point out, he just put an example down there. We did not ever watch Traore consistently beat Will Black in practice.
Yeah. Go ahead, Drew.
I mean, I think, O'Malley, you asked this question of Marcus Freeman about Leonard Moore versus Micah Gilbert last weekend, and he talked about you can't just look at the result. You have to, I'm sure you're looking at a technique if they're doing things differently. Are they taking your feedback? If Will Black's getting beat by Traore on a certain move consistently, is he learning to adjust and things like that? So I'm sure there's more that goes into it. But yeah, I think it does make it evaluation a little bit difficult. But you also should know, especially in an instance like Will Black, where he is super talented and he's getting a lot of reps against guys who, some of those way too early mock drafts are coming out and have Traore as a potential first rounder next year. You know he's getting a lot of good reps that are going to help him, but you want to see that he's improving throughout the spring. not just consistently making similar mistakes and not taking your feedback. But Will Black even mentioned that when he gets beat, he knows it's one and two things usually, and he is working to minimize those things. So I think they have that type of feedback in his head already.
I think you, I mean, you have to take the entire body of work. And it reminds me of the discussion about Christian Gray, because Notre Dame, a larger growing segment of fans are disillusioned with Christian Gray as a corner. And I come back and say, that's why Mekhi Lemon is a first round draft pick. That's why Jeremiah Smith will be a top five, top three draft pick next year. Great receivers beat DBs and great. Yeah,
Carl Tate went fourth. Yeah.
You know, and great pass rushers can beat very good tackles. I don't think that Boubacar Traore is consistently beating Will Black in practice, but how do you evaluate it? If Will Black is winning most of the time against most normal human beings that he's going against, well, then he's a pretty good player. Will he get beat by a Traore or a good pass rusher? Yeah, that absolutely happens. Remember, you know, Anthony Knapp in his first career start as a true freshman going against Nick Scorton, and he did a really, really nice job that night. And the following week or the week after, he was beaten inside. That's going to happen. You can't look at these guys and expect them to never make a mistake, especially when you're going against quality competition. So it's an entire body of work kind of thing, and it will be a bumpy road for Will Black along the way at times, just as it was at times for Anthony Knapp. But one defeat every three games that stands out does not mean that player is not a capable football player.
Our next question is from Frick50. What was the most encouraging and most concerning thing we learned this spring that's relevant to the season?
Most encouraging thing is that it's not just a giant collection of people that look at the roster and talk about it being the deepest since Lou Holtz, blah, 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 all the time. I think the defense showed a lot of depth, and the offense and the wide receiver showed enough depth that I think they'll find playoff quartet of wide receivers as the playoff approaches. We have receiver questions too, but the real key is when you get in those playoff games, you need the guy like Jaden Greathouse to show up and make plays, or you have no shot in the game. You can't win. I mean, that Penn State would have beaten Notre Dame if they had one guy make a play on Leonard Moore or Christian Gray. They actually had zero guys make a play on Leonard Moore or Christian Gray, statistically and completely. I mean, it's part of the sport now. I really think it's encouraging that they will find four, in my opinion, from the six or seven we talk about.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm really encouraged. I liked Jaden Sanders when I saw his Michigan film, and now after Saturday, but even before that, I felt like there were some really good things about him, and we know that Kari Adams will be back. I don't know exactly where he is in his shoulder rehab, but that secondary there's a bunch of good players there. Mark Zachary IV, I thought, had a really nice bounce back performance. He did have a pass broken up later in the scrimmage on Saturday after having a tough jersey scrimmage. So I'm encouraged by that. I think that we can sit here and say, wow, they got 15 receivers, and I agree with you, Tim. I think it will all shake out eventually, but as spring is ending and you look at the W receivers, and I made a statement, I said Gilbert had a tough spring or bad spring, and that was really unfair. He did not have a good jersey scrimmage and blue gold game, so I should have said that. Now, were those two of the most important days from the spring? Yeah, I think to a large extent that they were, but and it's been said a couple times on our message board, does he have enough speed? I'm questioning that myself off the snap of the football. You have Porter coming off of a knee injury. Cam Williams is the speed guy, but I don't think anybody in Notre Dame's camp thinks that Cam Williams is a number one W for a team that expects to go undefeated during the regular season and do some damage in the playoffs. He's getting better. He has speed, and I thought Sanders showed him the respect for the speed that he has that maybe Gilbert doesn't have. And then, you know, and then you have Fitzgerald, who I think he is going to be a factor even when he's going against some of these better DBs. I would like to see him take some reps against those better DBs, but we in the media didn't have an opportunity to see that this spring.
Would you say that makes them discouraging or encouraging for the question?
I'm discouraged by the W's, because there are a lot of receivers, but who is the guy there? Could Greathouse go out there? That's not necessarily, if that was his strong suit, if that was his best position, he would have spent more time out there prior to this point in his career. So look, nobody has a pat hand. I don't expect Notre Dame to walk out of the spring and be perfect at every position. I know a lot of people do. That's why the angst. I think we should have felt more surprised by what happened with CJ Carr Saturday as opposed to angst, because he truly is a Heisman Trophy candidate going into this. And what happened Saturday isn't going to change that. But as we walk out of the spring, it's like, okay, do they have what they need at W? Because Malachi Fields, he only caught 37 passes, but he averaged 17.5 and had 5 touchdowns. And I don't think they have that answer at that position right now.
You have one, Drew?
I mean, I agree. I think Mylon Graham and what Jordan Faison can do, I think that's a big encouragement in seeing that they look really good on that side of the offense. And I would also say that the boundary receiver is more of a question mark than maybe I thought it would. Obviously, we knew Quincy Porter wasn't going to be available, but I thought I'd probably see more out of Mike Gilbert and just his ability to win contested catches.
Question number 4 is from Irish Morg 22. Given all that was seen during spring ball, do you have more confidence that this year's quarterback number 2 is already on campus?
It hasn't changed for me. I think quarterback number 2 for Wisconsin's on campus.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of putting it, that it's going to be hard for Teddy Girard to be so up to speed that he's ready to be the backup for game 1 in Lambeau Field. But I mean, I do feel I've seen more from Noah Grubbs than I thought I was necessarily going to, which maybe gives me more confidence than I had coming into the spring. I don't know that my opinion on Blake Hebert has changed that much, but I agree. I still see Teddy Girard coming into a situation where by October, or when we really get to the meat of the season, he is the number 2 quarterback. I don't think either of them have done enough to dispel me of him thinking Girard has a good opportunity.
I would agree. And it's, I mean, not only does Teddy Girard have to wait till the summer to you know, start the indoctrination, but he's still a senior in high school, so it's kind of a double whammy here. Can he pick everything up? Will he be? Is he more accurate than Grubbs and Hebert? Maybe. Can he pick things up, read coverages, and all the things that go with that set pass blocking schemes and things like that? The only way to answer that is on the Notre Dame practice field with him wearing a Notre Dame uniform. We can sit and speculate. In Notre Dame, their coaches can sit and speculate, but they don't know until they actually see them wearing a uniform and going through the paces and looking and having to decipher what the other two guys have had to decipher this spring. So is he on campus now? Maybe, but I think Teddy Girard is good enough that, and that neither of the other two on campus did enough this spring where you can say, yeah, definitely number 2 is there.
Yeah, I think Girard, I mean, he has he's got the install, he's got the offense that's publicized pretty well, that he has everything he needs from Notre Dame, but that's the first install, and he hasn't gone through it he hasn't gone through it seeing defensive backs flying around. But I do think the days are gone of like, oh my gosh, here's the offense, Teddy, it's June 26th, try to figure it out. Like, I think he's far enough along now mentally. You just got to put it on the field. I just assume quarterback number 2 for the listing of Wisconsin is going to be one of the guys that's here. And I hope not. I think it'd be incredible if Teddy Girard comes and he's quarterback number 2. And I don't mean hope because I care who it is. That means he's really picking stuff up. If he shows up in the summer, gets that install from the spring, goes into August, can take the second install and never have to go to the scout team. There's not a lot. I mean, CJ Carr was on the scout team and he got hurt. So there you go. Next question. 2-parter. Irish, I was tailgating. Did Emil Wagner and Billy Schroth make a poor decision entering the NFL draft this year instead of waiting after next season? And a related note, Maltese Irish, what deficiencies, either in athleticism or physical traits and or their tape, kept such productive players as Wagner, Pauling, and he added Devonta Smith, even though he was injured, from being drafted?
Drew?
I think it's fair to question their business decisions of Wagner and Trout. I think for Wagner, he probably would have made a lot more money had he transferred. I don't think coming back to Notre Dame was a decision. And I think sometimes people, if you're lucky that you're Notre Dame, you're going to preach 4 for 40 and 4 for forever and all these things, that sometimes guys also feel ready to move on with their lives. If you're Emil Wagner, people of Aqua said he should run for president one day. I think he's a guy who wants to play his football as long as possible, but he's also probably less afraid than you would think of that next chapter of his life too. So I think he was comfortable with that decision. I do think Wagner should have come, or Trouth should have come back to Notre Dame. I don't think he took the pre-draft process. I don't know. I don't want to say he took it seriously, but he never tested, even though he's a guy people had curiosity about his injury history and things like that. He did, you know, even at Notre Dame's pro day, he only like did the on the field drills with Wagner. I don't think he did any shuttling, any running, things like that. So he put together his best tape against USC when he got hurt. And I think he should have come back and probably built on that. Would have probably been the best financial decision for him. Quickly, Wagner's biggest deficiency, I think, is, I mean, he got beat a decent amount in pass pro, especially against Miami. And, I mean, putting up 21 reps of 225, I think, was the second worst amongst tackles or offensive linemen overall at the combine. So I think some of those strength things are a question mark for him.
It's an interesting comment, and I agree with you, Drew, that I think Wagner's best business decision was to transfer. And, you know, so many guys transfer that we just assume that, okay, when in doubt, go ahead and transfer. Maybe an Emil Wagner just wasn't comfortable doing something like that.
Yeah, so, I don't, you know, think
what? Right. He's not the – it does, like he – I don't know that Pete Bavakwa did him any favors by saying he should be president someday. NFL teams hear that. They don't want it. Yeah. They don't want to hear anything like that. And, I'm not saying that Bavakwa's comment – had anything to do with it, but NFL teams are very much aware of, through the years, through decades, of Notre Dame players being too cerebral, being too academic, having too many options beyond the NFL. Well, now the NFL pays so much that most of those guys look at that opportunity as a tremendous opportunity, and you can't pass it up. But, and you know what? Shrouth was ready to. Now, I don't know what his offer was.
I think he could have made a lot more coming back to Notre Dame.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right.
Everybody can make more transferring. But I'm saying Shrouth could have made more at Notre Dame than he made last year. Wagner would have made less.
I agree.
And made a ton more somewhere else. So that makes that the business.
They wholeheartedly wanted Shrouth back. They didn't want Wagner back at the price tag that it would have cost them.
It was high. So yeah.
And understandable on his part. That's all good. You know, like Drew said, 21 reps at 225, that's not enough for an offensive tackle. And, you know, the other stuff that I mentioned, Will Pauling, first of all, there's a lot of great players in the country that you're competing against there. And you had said, Tim, all along that Will Pauling, you know, there's dozens of guys like that. And we all agreed with that till he ran a 4.37 on
he's
pro
still
day.
Not listed. I know it's just the NFL doc, but he's still not listed as a top 20 free agent wide receiver.
Yeah. And yet,
I think we have just look at Notre Dame too much. You know, there's plenty of wide receivers out there.
No,
I think Will Pauling can make the 49ers. I think he'll outwork someone and make the 49ers too. And they have bad receivers. So that helps.
Well, it's tough when you, I mean, his, I looked at, I mean, he had what, 26 catches for 381 yards or something like this last year. And that's comparable to Jaden Thomas's numbers from 2022. So I don't think he had this production this past year, but I also think it's worth noting too, with the Matt Wagner as well, is that it's better to go undrafted than it is to be a seventh round pick. Have less negotiating power. You don't get to pick your situation. Like it's certainly possible somebody wanted to take one of those two guys in the seventh round and their agent was like, don't take my guy. We know where we wanted to go. Like that stuff happens. So that could play into them drafting. Whereas Rubio, sixth round, maybe his agent was like, yeah, we'll definitely get drafted. You know, he probably was going to have less negotiating power either. So I don't know those conversations happen for sure, but I think it's certainly possible.
And Devonta Smith, I think, is coverage.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was just going to say. I mean,
there is a reason, and it's not a good one, but there is a reason that Carson Hobbs started at nickel and played more nickel snaps than Devonta Smith against Miami. Not a good reason. In retrospect, but they probably worried about Devonta Smith in slot coverage against that speed. There was one play he was isolated against Tony, his incomplete pass, a little bit of an overthrow, and you could argue Devonta Smith interfered too on the play. He still would have done better than Carson Hobbs did.
He probably
would have. Tony Alva, that was chosen by the people. So
yeah.
Our next question is another two-parter. The first is from ND Quebec. After the totality of spring practice, do you guys still think that Micah Gilbert will start at the boundary receiver in Wisconsin? Another part from Eddie Davis, too. Whose job is Devin Fitzgerald taking?
Tim?
He's taking someone's. Someone's getting their job taken in the top six by Devin Fitzgerald as the season progresses. Gilbert, I need to know Quincy Porter's health in July.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Whereas going into the spring, you know, I think we all thought that, okay, Gilbert will start and Porter will work in and maybe he'll get more snaps as the season progresses. But Gilbert, I think Gilbert left the door open. He left doubt. Leave no doubt.
That's a great way to
Freeman says. And I think that he left out this spring.
Is he the Northern Illinois game or the Texas A&M game and how we left him?
And then, I mean, Fitzgerald is a, he's been working at the W. Can you move him around? Yes.
I don't think they need to be so rigid on the positions. I think we're like, they're searching for a W receiver. You can put the four best receivers on the field if it's two slots and two X's and man have one of them on the boundary.
But you want size there. Like you can put Elijah Burris there, but you're not, that's not the kind of matchup that you want size wise.
I know. I just like people to get open.
Yeah. And I think the thing with Gilbert too is like, I mean, he's not a burner. He's not huge. He doesn't have Malachi Fields size or anything like that. But so you have to be able to win contested catches. And I don't think we've seen that. We've seen a little bit of that from Fitzgerald, which maybe gives him, I think we've seen him do a little bit of everything, obviously against lesser competition. But I think we've seen him win some contested catches. And I can't think of, I know you're going against Leonard Moore in the Jersey scrimmage. Like contested catches are that much harder. But with some, maybe some of his physical limitations, you want to see him maybe win some of those plays like you would have Bo Collins or something like that. And I don't think we've seen that out of Micah Gilbert as much.
Great example, Bo Collins, because I was going to say Chase Claypool, but that's way too high of a level. But the Bo Collins would have made one or two competitive catches, don't you think, Tim Priester, if you're going out there against
him? Yes. Moore? Yeah. And I mean, of everything I wrote about Tale of Tape, I was definitely the most critical of Micah Gilbert because I don't.
You had him as a starter.
But I'm talking about specifically what happened on Saturday. Okay. The deep ball stopping and coming back and going through the catch radius of the DB is that's really difficult to do. But he turned potentially a 50-50 ball into a 90-10 ball for Sanders. I mean, Sanders knocked that. He easily batted that pass away. And I think too many times Micah Gilbert's trying to catch the ball waist high or chest high. That's a ball you've got to go back up into the DB. You have to make the catch above your head with your hands. You can't be reaching here. It's not going to get there. The DB is going to get his hands on the ball before it gets to you chest high or waist high. He's just got to be more physical in that situation because that's why the W is, that's why you like size at that position. You're working with less field and you're in a one-on-one situation and you've got to be able to compete for the 50-50 balls and not give the advantage back to the corner.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think he did anything to shield Sanders from making a play on that ball. And I think that's the type of thing you need to see him be able to do, especially when he doesn't have some of those other gifts, as I mentioned, to get open in other ways.
Question number 7 from Irish B. What non-starters do you expect to be in your top 22 players when you do your player rankings, and what starters do you expect to be outside the top 22? Good question. Made me go back and because I've already, well, I haven't done post blue gold game adjustments, but really good question because there can be.
Oh yeah. There's non-starters that make the top 22.
Right. But there are fewer of those than. Yeah.
You have to have some. Like, there's no way you think the top 22 is just the top 22 starters because that's
right,
not.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think looking at it, I mean, I think Luke Talich was borderline, has a chance, especially if they're finding different ways to get on the field. He wouldn't technically be a starter. I mean, there's four linebackers who could be in my top 22, but only two will technically be a starter. So I think that's going to be a really interesting one to look at. I mean, you have kind of the running back situation, Nolan James. I think if he's not technically the starter or Aeneas Williams, like both of those guys, I think could be in the top 20. I mean, we had two in the top, I think I had two in the top six running back, two running backs in the top six last year. So it seems totally plausible. You could still have two in the top 22. I mean, the offensive line, I think if we're looking at guys who are starters that don't make it, will always be interesting. Like how does Will Black play? That's a guy who's kind of in that range for me. Joe Adine, I don't know if he's going to start. Ashton Craig, I don't know when he'll be back, type of thing. So those, you know, one of those guys could be the starter, but maybe I'm having them slotted lower. Same with Sullivan Absher, kind of even worse, where he could still get beat out. So I think looking at those guys is not outside of the top 22 is all potential.
I look back at last year's, this is our list, not my list, that I want to clarify from last time. I see four guys that started a lot, not in the top 22. Rubio doesn't count, right? He was hurt a lot. Osbury, Patello doesn't count. He was injured. Burnham, Pauling, either Onye or Heinisch, you got to count one of them as a starter. I don't know if you want to count, but one of those guys as a starter. This year, I would say I will have two offensive linemen not in my top 22. I think there's just some gray area with Otting and Craig.
I mean, I won't have Black in my top 22. He hasn't played yet.
I won't have Absher in my top 22.
And I won't have, and I wouldn't have Absher in the top 22 either. Just what we can only go on what we know now, you know. And then and KVA presents his own problems because we don't know exactly when he'll, you know, he'll be back. But
I might have five linebackers. In my
how
top
do you have like how yeah. do you put?
I'm kidding. I really might. It's possible, man. It's a the 15 or 16 game season. You think I'm getting the fifth best guard out or the fifth best lineman out there? No way.
No, it's pretty hard not to have four linebackers in your top 22.
Right. Yes.
I think they're all kind of worthy of that. But, you know, where do, especially now coming out of the spring, where do we put Greathouse? I mean, I can't put him in top 22. I don't know, you know, who he would nudge out at this point. Onye probably won't be in the top 22.
Well, it's a fun thing when you have depth. It's even when they don't have depth, the top 22 doesn't even hold. You have low depth in the top 22, which would probably be the top 22.
And I think if most people on the outside were ranking them, they may not have Cooper Flanagan in the top 22. But I promise you, he's in my top 22 because he's just that valuable to the entire operation of the offense.
Next question, number 8 from Pimpin' Is Easy. O'Malley's realistic upside statistics and argument with John Bryce for Quincy Porter got me thinking last week. What are Aeneas Williams' realistic upside statistics? Rushing, receiving, and total TD, anything you want to handle there?
I'll say this. Jeremiah Love had 280 yards receiving, and you know that he's spectacular in everything that he does. Aeneas Williams will have more than 280 yards receiving. Just because we saw instances I wrote about in today's Tale of the Tape about how they can use him. They split him out. He was the number one, the wide receiver in a trips formation. They brought him back in motion toward the snap of the football. Swing passes. You can be a really, really fast, quick linebacker, but you're going to have a hard time catching up with Aeneas Williams swinging out of the backfield if they throw him the football. So my prediction there is he'll have more yards than Love had, which was 280. He'll get goal line carries. I think that'll be the guy that they're going to go to on the goal line. So how many touchdowns does an Aeneas Williams get when you're accustomed to Jeremiah Love getting the bulk of them the last couple of years? Well, and Audric Estime the year before that.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at Audric Estime's sophomore year when he split a lot of reps with Diggs, and he had 164 touches that year. Now, he couldn't catch the ball that well, but he had, I think, 1,055 total yards, 12 touchdowns. I could see Williams, because he's going to be so much better in the passing game, having, I think, maybe a realistic upside. It is 800 to 900 yards rushing, 300-plus yards receiving, and like a dozen touchdowns or so is where I put that. Kyren Williams' sophomore year was much more than that, but he had 246 touches. I just don't see Aeneas Williams getting anywhere close to that level of run.
Yeah, I tried to look at the last time they had depth offensively for this, which was like 2015. I'm not kidding, really. because, you know, they didn't have any receivers in the end of the Brian Kelly era. I have a stat to prove that for you. They had Kyren Williams was totally relied on when he was the bell cow of the offense. But 2015, great offense. CJ Prosize, talented wide receiver, right? Moved to running back, certainly a accomplished guy. He had 26 catches for over 300 yards and a touchdown. Theo Riddick is the best example. He was getting close to 400 yards, but they also had three guys on offense with a pulse, so it makes it a little less. It was Eifert, Riddick, and TJ Jones. I think Aeneas Williams is third on the team in receptions, not third on the team in yards, but over 300 yards, 300 to 400 yards. And I'm double digit touchdowns because I'm including a few catches for touchdowns.
I said recently, I don't know how many weeks ago on a podcast, I think there was like a 90 some carry discrepancy between Love and Price, and that it'll be a lot closer this year with James. Now that we're exiting the spring, I still think it'll be closer than that. I'm having a hard time figuring out exactly how many touches Nolan James Jr. is going to get.
Yeah, that is tough.
Per game. And that, of course, impacts the numbers that Aeneas Williams gets. It's an interesting question. I don't have the full answer. I don't know that I would necessarily say 800 to 900 yards, Drew. I would say maybe 750. But I'm right with you on the amount of touchdowns. It's just a little bit trickier projecting Nolan James.
I think they'll insert. I got to go closer to 900. I mean,
yeah.
Tony Jones had 857.
Okay. Well, Yeah. Okay. I hear you. And they're going to play. I'm pretty sure they're going to play more than 12 games this year.
Our podcast is going to be terrible next December. It's really going to be one of the worst things you ever listen to. So
that's we're looking at realistic upside too, not necessarily like where we think they'll go.
No, that's fair. It'll just be interesting to see the balance and carries between the two. Because I know they love Nolan James too, but a healthy Aeneas Williams full go is a guy that's going to get a fair amount of the touches, no doubt about it.
I've been saying for a month Aeneas Williams affects the receivers' totals. Nolan James affects Aeneas Williams' running back totals. It's just, it has to work that way. Maybe, and if not, if there's an injury, Jonas Walton works his way into. Final question, TD Irish. In hindsight, we all underestimated the impact of a new defensive coordinator last year. What challenge facing this year's team are we underestimating? I want to stress that has nothing to do necessarily with the new defensive coordinator.
Drew?
I mean, if we really have to look at it that way, I mean, the loss of Love and Price, we could be underestimated. I mean, we're counting on CJ Carr taking a big step, which I think is definitely realistic. But for as good as we think Aeneas Williams is, everything he did in the playoffs 2 years ago, like, you are replacing two of the best running backs Notre Dame's had in the last 30 years, and all the different things that did, how that probably made CJ Carr's life a lot easier last year in ways that maybe we aren't totally aware of. So if I had to go one thing where we're overestimating it, I would probably look at just the offense's ability to function consistently without those two guys in the backfield. Maybe we're overlooking.
I think that's the number one choice that not enough time is being spent thinking about just what you lost with Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price. The other thing, you know, we can sit here and say, you know, Ian Premmer is a great receiving tight end, and, you know, he's a guy that's going to come in and impact the passing game right away, but we don't know that for sure. And so therefore, you know, who is your pass catching tight end, which to me, that ties in with some of the questions that you have about the boundary receiver. If you don't have a volume receiver at tight end either, that's a little bit concerning. Big picture, the expectation for perfection is going to run rampant as this season starts. We dealt with this on the message board a couple weeks ago about, well, they should win every game by 3 touchdowns. Well, that's not going to happen, and nobody can do that. We see that every year, year after year in college football. Nobody can do that. So that's kind of an external thing, but I think the expectation for perfection is going to impact the way Notre Dame fans talk about this team, because if they're not winning by 3 touchdowns every week, then the perception is that they're doing something wrong, and that's just not realistic.
The Love Price thing for me is not on my list because I have not underestimated it at all at any point since they left. I was like, wait, that's the number one problem on the team is they don't have Love and Price. That's why I said they weren't even as talented as the last year's team was, because they had Love and Price. Those guys were insane. I still love the quarterback comparison we did a couple weeks ago. What's the more talented room, this one or 2024? And CJ Carr was fourth string in 2024, and we somehow all ignored that when we talked about the most talented room. But I actually think Cooper Flanagan could be just as good of a receiving tight end as Eli Raritan. So that's not a huge one.
Oh, I don't.
For me,
I don't.
Either. I don't. I mean, I think he can score touchdowns and be a threat.
When's the last?
When last time he was healthy? I mean,
when's the last time they threw to him?
I mean, we saw two practices. We saw two practices. We only saw two practices. We saw two total practices where they threw the people. I mean, jersey scrimmage and blue goal game. I think Flanagan can do, I mean, one of 32 catches because they have better receivers than.
Well, how many passes did he catch Saturday?
How many catches did Jordan Faison have Saturday? Who cares about the blue goal game's catches by the tight end? Wait a minute, I'm not banking a single thing on Cooper Flanagan's pass catching Saturday.
Well, I understand, but they've never.
Cam Williams looked great.
I understand. I don't think
Cooper Flanagan could be a viable tight end receiving.
When has the Notre Dame coaching staff thought that Cooper Flanagan was a real viable pass catching?
He didn't play all of last year, and he was the third string tight end the year before.
Well, that's true, but
how could he have had a chance? He's had a torn ACL since IU week.
I understand, but I don't think Cooper Flanagan was ever at the forefront of their minds as a 50 catch.
He won't catch 50 on this team, but he can be a 25 catch and 3 touchdown tight end. Is that worse than 32-0?
They're comparable.
Okay, I think Cooper Flanagan could be a productive receiving tight end. Okay.
If he is, that will benefit the offense greatly.
Yeah,
I just, you're right. He has been injured, and you had Mitchell Evans prior to that. But I don't ever remember any feedback saying, "Oh, we like throwing the football to Cooper Flanagan."
I think he'll be more of a safety situation. Like I could see him getting away with a lot of like he starts blocking and then peels out for a route and gets it dumped down and stuff like that. He's not going to have the big plays that we saw from Eli Raritan, but I agree. I wouldn't be surprised if he had
Eli Raritan.
Miami. He had several over like 30, Miami, 40 yards.
I think Cooper Flanagan will have, when Cooper Flanagan's a senior like Eli Raritan, he'll be just as good as Eli Raritan. I think Eli Raritan was way more what everybody tells us about him than what actually happened. He wasn't targeted in the end zone until game 11.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I just feel like Cooper Flanagan will be just fine.
Well, and when he was targeted in the red zone, they tackled him at the one.
I mean, in the end zone.
A half yard, yeah.
Yeah.
I can see Flanagan.
He had plenty of red zone. He was tackled just short all the time. What's the joke? He could have won the Mackey if he just fell forward. I think Cooper Flanagan will be a good receiving tight end.
I think he'll be a sensational blocking tight end. Yeah, I don't. Yeah.
So he's not,
keep him on the field for sure, which could help him in the receiving ultimately too.
He's not terribly low or terribly high on my list of concerns. I think the offensive line is my biggest concern. I don't mean against Wisconsin and Rice and those things. I'm talking about when Miami comes to town. They don't get their asses kicked by BYU up front or Miami or a playoff game. They'll handle their business against all the teams that they always handle their business against. I think the offensive line is a concern for me for playoff wins, not for.
Yeah, I think I would have gone there. I just think they have so much time to get there in the season where they didn't have that last year. So maybe I'll be with you if we're in late September. I'm like, they're still not looking amazing against Rice and North Carolina, maybe if they haven't improved substantially too. So I think my thing with offensive line is we don't need them to be great right away. Whereas I guess we might with some of these other positions.
I think chemistry of an offensive line is a concern every year, unless you're returning five guys that are all coming back at the same position, which is, you know, they've moved around a couple different positions here with these guys. That's always a concern going into the year, especially when you're opening with Miami and Texas A&M.
I was just going to say it wasn't as big of a concern last year, and there was Miami and Texas A&M, but they did lose Jugs, so that was, they didn't return as much as many people as we thought they would lose. We'll be back Thursday. There'll be still be blue goal game talk because we won't see any more football practices until next August, but we will try to branch out a little bit from there. I think the NFL draft has been put to rest. Drew Mintock, fantastic job since the combine started, and now it's up to the guys just to make teams. As you know, it doesn't matter where you were drafted once you make plays in September. That's what happens in the NFL. And the same thing will happen when Notre Dame comes and Cooper Flanagan catches 67 passes for 14 touchdowns this year. Until then, for Tim Priester and Drew Mintock, I am Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening. Irish Illustrated Insider.